Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom, Sabbath greetings on this 29th day of the first month of the sacred calendar. Tomorrow is the last day of the month. New moon is on Monday, the new moon of the second month, a month called Iyar for the last many hundreds of years. I did mention to you that the last day of unleavened bread, by the way, I should comment right away that we are in a different location. So yes, you're right. If you guessed I'm speaking to you from a different location, yes, you're correct. When you're a dissenter, you've got to keep on the move. So we go from place to place here. Want to be a moving target. Hopefully I'm kidding. Anyway, I told you that the last day of unleavened bread, whatever day of the week it is also the day when the Israeli Independence Day occurs. So, as you know, the last day of unleavened bread was a Friday. You all recall that. So the Independence Day of the State of Israel, the fifth day of the second month, occurs this year on a Friday. However, it'll be celebrated, because we don't want to disrupt the Sabbath. It'll be celebrated on Thursday, which will be, let me see, April 20th is Monday, first, second, third, right? Thursday, April 23rd is when Israelis will be celebrating their Independence Day. Also, last week on the Roman calendar, I believe April 14th was the date, the 150th anniversary of the assassination of President Lincoln. I believe it was on the day that people observe as Good Friday when he was murdered. And so there were a lot of commemorations of Lincoln in recent days. And he's known, of course, worldwide. Here in America, we have him on our $5 bill and on our penny, so we really can't avoid seeing him. I'd like to go to the book of Hebrews. You know, when I was a boy, a long time ago, when I was a boy, I had the opportunity to have... Okay, when I was a boy, I had the opportunity to have free admission to a blockbuster movie. It was about 10 years after it had first been released. It was a film that won 2 Academy Awards, made a great deal of money. And we were able to see it for free when it was reissued when I was a boy. And why was that? Why did I get to see it for free? The movie was Cecil B. DeMille's Samson and Delilah. And I got to see it for free because I was a member of a youth group called Shimshon, the Samson Youth Group. Eventually, I became president of that youth group. And because we were named Samson, Shimshon, the Warner Theater in Bridgeport, Connecticut, was kind enough to give us free admission to the movie, Samson and Delilah. And Cecil B. DeMille, as you know, Hollywood strives for authenticity. And so as Samson's Philistine bride, there was a perfect fit in the casting, Angela Lansbury. She was the Philistine bride of Victor Mature, who played Samson in that movie. As I said, just perfect casting. I guess Angela Lansbury can play anybody. She's very talented. I'd like to go to Hebrews 11 and verse 32. We live in an age of superheroes on film, and this is part of human nature. The Greeks had their mythology. They had Hercules. Well, there was a real superhero in the Bible, Samson, Shimshon. We call him Shimshon HaGibor, Samson the Mighty. And he is a biblical superhero, in a sense, a real superhero. So I call this talk today, I will call this talk Lessons from a Real Superhero. Real life. Pardon me?
You said real life superhero.
From a real what?
Real life superhero.
No, but that's okay. Yeah, real superhero is good enough, yeah. Okay. Lessons from a real superhero. Good enough. Mm-hmm. Lessons from a real superhero. Because he was a historical character, and he was given special power by God, a very unique character in the Bible. But you know what? First, we have to understand something about strength and what real strength, this real strength that is important. But I want to first talk about Samson. What does the New Testament tell us about Samson? He is indeed in the Faith Hall of Fame. You may remember Hebrews 11 tells us, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Pistis in the Greek, emunah in the Hebrew. And in Hebrews 11:32, we read this. I'm going to read this. And what more shall I say? Hebrews 11:32. For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David, and Samuel and the prophets. So we have seven, of course. Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets. Seven, of course. And what about them? Who through faith, verse 33, subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned in flight the armies of the aliens. Heroic feats as God inspired these Old Covenant characters, these Old Testament personalities, of which Samson is mentioned here, the third in the list here. Samson, Shimshon, he's called in Hebrew Shimshon HaGibor, Samson the Mighty. But you know, true might is strength of character. It's wonderful to be strong physically, but what's really important is to control oneself. As the Pirkei Avot tells us, the Ethics of the Fathers, Ezehu Gibor, who is mighty? Hakovesh et Yitzro, he who conquers his inclination, self-control. I'd like to go to Proverbs 16:32 to make that point. Proverbs 16 and verse 32. So yes, it's good to have strength and to be physically strong. We would certainly to be admired. But as I said, self-control is really what's important in seeking God's kingdom. Proverbs 16:32. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. But obviously, in times of battle, in ancient times when there were wars involving the people of Israel, physical strength was certainly very important, and Samson was given special power by God to defend his people. The time had come for God to deliver his people and to consolidate the various tribes into a unified nation. We're at the end of the Judges period at the time of Samson, and the country is beginning to consolidate, and ultimately it would consolidate under the leadership of Samuel, the judge and prophet. And of course, as you know, they insisted on having a king, so then the next step was the united monarchy under Saul. But we're coming now to the end of the Judges period and the time of the consolidation of Israel as God begins to deliver them. And in the southwest, the problem was oppression by the Philistines, those who were based in what is today Gaza. And the Philistines, the territory of the tribe of Dan was near where the Philistines were. The tribe of Dan was on the coast of Israel in the area of Jaffa. Today, the city of Tel Aviv is there, and if you ride the buses there, they bear the name of Dan, reminding you that Dan was the tribe given that area of Jaffa and Tel Aviv. And if you go further south and west, then you come to Gaza. And so you have these areas where the Philistines were in control. There's a kibbutz in the southwest called Sora, which a lot of the people who live there are Jews who came from South Africa. And Sora was where Samson was born. We're going to talk about Samson today, but I'm not going to focus on Delilah. That's often the focus. In fact, even the movie that Cecil B. DeMille did was entitled Samson and Delilah. That really draws the crowds. That's not my focus today. I'd like to go to Judges 13. And I want to say something else about the calendar. I said today was the 29th day of the first month. The 27th day of the first month on the sacred calendar has been designated as Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day. And that day was chosen because it's midpoint at the time of the uprising at the Warsaw Ghetto. The Warsaw fighters saw that the Germans were exterminating them. It was genocide. The extermination of an entire race was the goal. And so the Jews of Warsaw said, as Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. That was their motto. Let me die with the Philistines. And so I want to go to that portion of Judges where Samson has been blinded and humiliated, of course, and he's being taunted here. But in verse 30 of Judges 16, then Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And I'll finish the thought later about what he did, what he accomplished. But before that time, he was specially chosen. And we go back to number 6. I won't turn there. But in number 6, we see that people could become Levites for a time. They could serve in the temple for a time by setting themselves apart as Nazirites. They would be consecrated. Nazir means consecrated, dedicated, separated, and has no connection with the term Nazareth. Nazareth, the city of Nazareth, Nazareth, probably is related to the word Netzer, meaning branch. And so if somebody is Nazrati, if he comes from Nazareth or Nozri, it's not no connection in Hebrew with Nazir, a person who's a Nazirite. There's no connection between Nazarene and Nazirite. There's no connection. But a Nazir was one who was consecrated, dedicated, and one of the things that set them apart was not cutting their hair while they were serving as a Nazirite, and also not having any grape products, including wine. So this was a way of separating them out. Now, I was thinking, why separate them out by not having grape products? And I think one possible reason is... Okay. And I was wondering, why is it that grape products were forbidden to the Nazirite? And I was thinking that grape products, you know, grapes were very common in that part of the world. And so this caused them to not eat a food that was very common, but yet it wasn't necessarily any health problem or, you know, detriment. They could, I suppose, replace the grapes. There were pomegranates and other things they could eat, dates and, you know, other fruits that they could eat. But it did set them apart because grapes were so much a part of the diet. It did set them apart. And also not having the wine, it may be that they had no alcohol. And so in a sense, this was symbolic of maybe always being on the alert spiritually, never really totally relaxing and letting your guard down, perhaps. Alcohol is something to be enjoyed in moderation. God gave it to us that we would develop the character to enjoy it in moderation. But those set apart did not drink it. At least they didn't drink wine and possibly no alcohol. That seems to be the case of John the Baptist. John the Baptist, although a priest, was especially set apart as a Nazirite, if you read Luke, the first chapter, because his role was so important. In all history, he was the one who was the prophet before the coming of Jesus Christ. His role was so unique that even though he was already a priest by ancestry, he was also set apart as a Nazirite, as was Daniel, I mean, as was Samson. And Samson, I'm going to talk about now in Judges 13. I know I've given you a lot of background that you can maybe study into. You can go back to Luke 1. You can go back to number 6 and delve into it further. Judges 13. Again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal, and the Eternal delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. Now, there was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah. Manoah meaning rest, quiet, peace and quiet. And so that was what they were hoping for. And his wife was barren and had no children. I have been wondering since studying this portion, going back to it. He is named and his wife is not. It's kind of interesting. Both are given a little bit of a test. Manoah was given a test in that his wife, God appeared to his wife before God appeared to him both times. And his wife had to take him over to where God was appearing. The first time God appeared to her without him, the second time he appeared to her without him, but she brought him over there so he was able to see God as well. But his wife was always the first one. So that was a bit of a test for him. On the other hand, there's a test for her in that her name is not mentioned in this passage. So she has to go through, you know, so someday she'll be in the resurrection and she'll notice that the Bible doesn't include her by name. But anyway. Now there was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Eternal appeared. So here is the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. This is the angel of the Eternal. This is God as his messenger. This is the Malach Adonai. This is the Logos, the Word. So here we have God appearing as his own messenger in this form, as the Word of God, the God the Son, who later becomes the Son of God. I've said a lot. That is very theologically heavy, but I'll continue. And the angel of the Eternal appeared to the woman and said to her, "Indeed, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now, therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink and not to eat anything unclean." So obviously keep kosher, you know, biblically. That's of course obvious. This seems to indicate to me that at that point, a lot of people were not doing that in that day and time. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazirite to God from the womb. And he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. So this is the first stage of a deliverance. What he's going to do is going to prepare the way. He's not going to be the total answer, but that's the first step. So the woman came and told her husband. Of course, that's a very exciting thing. And she did not really understand who she had seen. It was like she saw this special man. He was radiant, perhaps. He looked like he was something special, but she didn't know if it was a human or a spirit. She figured him to be a great human. So the woman came and told her husband, saying, "A man of God came to me, and his countenance was like the countenance of the angel of God." Very awesome. But she still didn't quite understand that this was the angel of God. "But I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. And he said to me, 'Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. Now drink no wine or similar drink, nor eat. Now drink no wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.'" So what we see here is that she quotes very carefully what God said to her. Then Manoah prayed to the Eternal and said, "Oh, my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born." And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came to the woman again. So again, first coming to the woman, as she was sitting in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. Then the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said to him, "Look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me." It's interesting how God worked there. He appeared to the woman and let her go get the husband and bring him back to where he was. For whatever reason, that's how he chose to handle it. And I guess it was, in some sense, perhaps they would have been overwhelmed. If they had thought it was really God from the beginning, maybe they wouldn't have handled it. It would have been so traumatic. So they had to learn gradually with whom they were dealing. So he dealt with them in such a way that they would not be so terrified that maybe she would have fainted or something. So Manoah arose and followed his wife. When he came to the man, he said to him, "Are you the man who spoke to this woman?" And he said, "I am." Manoah said, "Now let your words come to pass. What will be the boy's rule of life and his work?" So the angel of the Eternal said to Manoah, "Of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. She may not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor may she drink wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. All that I commanded her, let her observe." Then Manoah said to the angel of the Eternal, "Please let us detain you, and we will prepare a young goat for you." He thought he was dealing with a human being. And the angel of the Eternal said to Manoah, "Though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you offer burnt offering, you must offer it to the Eternal." For Manoah did not know he was the angel of the Eternal. So now God wanted it to be very clear that this was a theophany. So he kind of put off his human facade and became more divine in their eyes. Then Manoah said to the angel of the Eternal, "What is your name, that when your words come to pass, we may honor you?" And here you see why Jesus had to be born a Jew, because he always answered a question with a question. And the angel of the Eternal said to him, "Why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?" Just like how he answered Jacob when he was wrestling with Jacob. So now Manoah understood the truth. So Manoah took the young goat with the grain offering and offered it upon the rock to the Eternal. And he did a wondrous thing while Manoah and his wife looked on. This confirmed it. It happened as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, the angel of the Eternal ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. So this was a theophany. This was, as I said, God as his own messenger, the word of God, the Logos. When the angel of the Eternal, the Aramaic term is Memra in the Aramaic tradition, when the angel of the Eternal appeared no more to Manoah and his wife, then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Eternal. He just disappeared. You know, he didn't walk away. He just disappeared miraculously. And Manoah said to his wife, "We shall surely die because we have seen God." So he was traumatized by this. But his wife was very wise and, you know, and said to him, "You know, if he did all this, he doesn't want us to die." Very, very wise answer. So he was got a bit over anxious here. But his wife said to him, "If the Eternal had desired to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he have told us such things as these at this time." So the woman bore a son and called his name Shimshon, Samson, coming from Shemesh, meaning the sun. So he was going to be an S-U-N. He was going to be a bright, shining, brilliant child. And the child grew, and the Eternal blessed him. And the Spirit of the Eternal began to move upon him at Machane Dan, between Sora and Eshtaol. So God was working with him and creating in him a great warrior who would deliver his people from the Philistines. And God allowed circumstances to work out so that Samson would in fact do this kind of thing. That he, in other words, he got him at odds with the Philistines so that he would inflict great harm on these oppressive people. Now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah, the daughter of the Philistines. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me as a wife. Now here was a man of God. Here was one who had been consecrated. But unfortunately, he did let his emotions get the better of him. See, that's why we can say that he was maybe very strong physically, but unfortunately not strong enough to control his passions. You know, he had a weakness for women, evidently, the wrong kind of women. And I want to go to Ephesians, the fifth chapter, Ephesians 5 and verse 15. We're told there by the Apostle Paul, see that you walk circumspectly, carefully. Carefully. See that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. This world has its challenges, its problems. It's marching to a different drummer, so we have to be very careful. Therefore, do not be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. And so we have to be careful when we make decisions, especially something as serious as marriage. So Samson, you know, let's say was perhaps being unwise here in his choice of a bride. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah, this is Judges 14, of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me as a wife. Then his father and mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. So that's a very sad story, that even when the parents objected, he still insisted. So he made his mistakes, and he, you know, obviously he paid for them. But his father and mother did not know that it was of the Eternal. So in this case, God was directing this in order that there be this tension between Samson and the Philistines. So God was at least allowing this, or even directing this, for in order that Samson would become an enemy of the Philistines. That he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines, for at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel, and evidently Samson needed this prod to do it. So Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother, and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now, to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him. Ah! So in those days there were still lions as far north of Africa as even into the Middle East and the land of Israel. There were still lions there, as you know, from reading about David. But God gave him extra strength to slay a lion. Wow. And the Spirit of the Eternal came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. Interesting. For whatever reason, he didn't boast about it. That's probably a positive trait. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. After some time, when he returned to get her, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. I'm in verse 8 now. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. It's a very fascinating situation. Now, when I was in this youth group, the Shimshon, we had teams. We organized the club into teams, and we would compete in answering questions. It was very much like Jeopardy. Although we didn't have to phrase it in answer what or what is or what was, you know, we just answered the question. But the head of the club, the patron, the adult who ran it, he said that Samson was the first quiz master of the Bible. That's how he called him. And so you know, we had a lot of questions and answers as part of my youth group. But anyway, he you'll see later on, he did a riddle based upon what he saw. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. He took some of it in his hands and went along eating, Now, I don't know. That sounds a little bit awkward, how he did that. Maybe he did also have some kind of container. I don't know. What did he do? He had hands full of honey and gave them to his parents. It seems a bit awkward here. When he came to his father and mother, he gave some to them, and they also ate. So what can I say? You know, if he had them in his hand, I guess they also scooped it into their hands and ate it. And he did not tell them that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. It's almost as if he wanted to keep it a secret, because later on he did have a riddle about it. So I guess he felt like he wanted to keep it a secret. So his father went down to the woman, and Samson gave a feast there for young men used to do so. So the custom was, before the consummation of the marriage, there'd be 7 days of feasting. That was the way they did it in those days. And it happened when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. So this is quite an occasion. Then Samson said to them, "Let me pose a riddle to you." And he also wagered on it. Now here again, that's not the best, the most positive kind of activity. So you see, there were times when he was a bit on, you know, in the gray side of life, the marginal side that we want to avoid. We want to avoid gambling. I would recommend that you avoid gambling. Then Samson said to them, "Let me pose a riddle to you. If you can correctly solve and explain it to me within the 7 days of the feast, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing." So how he planned to do this, I guess his family was well off enough, or somehow how he planned to do it. "But if you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing." And they said to him, "Pose your riddle that we may hear it." So they were willing to try their hand at lady luck, as it were. So he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet." And it's not something you would normally guess. A lion's carcass would have bees in it with honey. That's what he saw, an amazing sight. And I guess he kept it secret for such a time as that. Maybe he was a person who gambled as a habit, which again is not good. So he had his problems, as great a man as he was. And he was a great man, but he had certain vices, and this was one of them. Now for 3 days they could not explain the riddle. But it came to pass on the seventh day that they said to Samson's wife, you know, the one who was betrothed to him, I don't believe he had yet, you know, had the honeymoon, as it were, but they were about to be living together, "Entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so?" And then again, too, maybe many of them were actually of her own people, the Philistines, where he was a Danite, he was an Israelite. That might have been a factor. Then Samson's wife wept on him and said, "You only hate me. You do not love me. You have posed a riddle to the sons of my people, but you have not explained it to me." And he said to her, "Look, I have not explained it to my father and my mother, so should I explain it to you?" Now she had wept on him the 7 days while their feast lasted. So she, even herself, I guess, wanted to know this. And it happened on the seventh day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. Then she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. So you see, we're being prepared for what Delilah did later. While everybody knows the story of Samson and Delilah, this is not as well known a story. This kind of lays the groundwork for that. So the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, "What is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion?" Well, he figured out. This was really very silly on their part. Wouldn't he have figured out that they must have gotten to his wife? The whole thing, you could see how God was directing these events, because they, you know, they wouldn't be that logical otherwise. Sometimes God allows things to happen or directs things to happen for his purposes. And he said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." So he was a rather poetic person, as you'll see later. Very cleverly written, said. Then the spirit of the Eternal came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon. And he said, "All right, I'll pay you back my way," right? And so he began inflicting trouble on them. Then the spirit of the Eternal came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. So his anger was aroused, and he went back up to his father's house. So he never did have his honeymoon. He went down, killed these people, and brought their clothes back. "Here, you know, here's your winnings," you know. And but meantime, what about this intended woman? Well, her family figured he's angry now. He doesn't want her. And they gave her to the best man. Isn't that crazy? What a horrible thing. And Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his best man. Oh, no. Well, now he's so angry. What's he going to be like now? You know, adding salt on the wound, as it were. After a while, in the time of the wheat harvest, and that's coming up. That's the Pentecost season. That's the next holy day season. So late spring, Pentecost time. After a while, in the time of wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. And he said, "Let me go to my wife into her room." But her father would not permit him to go in. Now she was married to somebody else. You know, some things have changed in the meantime. Wow. Her father said, "I really thought that you thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead." So he had an option. I forget how Cecil B. DeMille handled it. It was a long time ago that I saw that movie. And Samson said to them, "This time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them." You know, and he figured, if you think you provoked me last time, now I'm really justified in dealing with you. Then Samson went and caught 300 foxes, and he took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, and put a torch between each pair of tails. When he had set the torches on fire, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and olive groves. He's really damaging these people. Now, these are the people that are oppressing the Israelites. And for whatever reason, the Israelites had not pushed them away. And even Samson had not yet led a revolt against them in any sense. But now he was. Now he was really doing damage to these oppressors. Then the Philistines said, "Who has done this?" And they answered, "Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite." Well, at least you know, he would have been. "Because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion." So that's why he did it. You know, he had his reasons. So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. Wow. So they're even, you know, look at how they handled it. They blamed them. And they said, you know, because what you did, we had all this trouble. So they burned her and her father with fire. Samson said to them, "Since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you. And after that, I will cease." So after what they did, he went after them again. See, they provoked him another time. So he attacked them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. Then he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Etam. So again, he attacks them. This is a third time as I'm reading through it that he does damage to the Philistines. So he's beginning to weaken this tyranny. Now the Philistines then went up, encamped in Judah, and deployed themselves against Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" Judah and Dan were neighbors. So they answered, "We have come up to arrest Samson to do to him as he has done to us." All right, we're now on verse 11. Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, "Do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? What is this that you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so have I done to them." But you see the situation, that the Jews were not willing to defend him, but rather they were willing to give him over to the Philistines. So they were still, in effect, a subjugated people who felt that they didn't have the power to overcome the tyrants that were oppressing them. So rather the best solution was to just give him over to them. But they said to him, "We have come down to arrest you, that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines." Then Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves." So they spoke to him, saying, "No, but we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hands. We will surely not kill you." And they bound him with new ropes and brought him up from the rock. So everybody followed the account here so far. Now he came to Lehi, the Philistines. When they came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. Oh, and then once again, God intervenes because God is using him to weaken these oppressors so that eventually Israel can break free. Then the Spirit of the Eternal came mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds broke loose from his hands. You could see why somebody wanted to make a movie about this. You know, he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. Wow. Reached out his hand and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. Now you think of the humiliation. One man kills 1,000 Philistines, one Danite. These are the people that were under the control of the Philistines. And here comes one of them, a Danite, an Israelite, and he kills 1,000 of them. And how? With the jawbone of a donkey? How humiliating. And he was very poetic and musical, you know, and so he does this play on words. Bilchi hamor, hamor hamoratan. Bilchi hamor, hamor hamoratan. That's the Hebrew. Bilchi hamor, hamor hamoratan. With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps. It's a play on words. It's a pun in Hebrew. Then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps. With the jawbone of a donkey, I've slain 1,000 men. So he boasted of it. He did poetry about it. I imagine it became a hit on the hit parade of those days. Now it was, so it was when he had finished speaking that he threw the jawbone from his hand and called that place Ramat Lehi, you know, jawbone height. It became the name of the place, jawbone height. Then he became very thirsty. So he cried out to the Eternal and said, you have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant. And now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised? So God split the hollow place that is in Lehi, and water came out, and he drank. And his spirit returned, and he revived. Therefore he called its name Ein HaKore, the spring of the caller, which is in Lehi to this day. So it's brought up because people at the time that this was written, perhaps at the time of Samuel, when it was written, could see the place where God had intervened and opened up this spring and brought water for Samson. So God intervened in a couple of ways there, gave him super strength to kill 1,000 people with the jawbone of a donkey, and then went ahead and opened up a source of water for him, which was still there, people could see at a later time. And he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. So he had a 20-year reign as a judge. And so we shouldn't take away from that. We see his vices portrayed in the Bible. He did have a weakness, particularly for evidently for Gentile women. What can I tell you? And he had certain vices, but he was also a very great hero. And he judged Israel for 20 years. So we need to keep in mind the positive. And of course, he died giving his life for his people. And in his death, accomplished more than he even did in his life, as you'll see in a moment. Now, Samson, I just want to show you just a little more about the negative side, too. As I said, he was a great man, but he had his weaknesses. Now, Samson went to Gaza and saw a harlot there and went into her. Well, again, not what he should have been doing. When the Gazites were told Samson has come here, they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. They were quiet all night, saying, in the morning, when it is daylight, we will kill him. Verse 3, and Samson lay low till midnight. When he arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city. These were major architectural works. And he took these doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. About more than 64 kilometers, about 40 miles, he carried these items. Superhuman, supernatural, a superhero. And so obviously that would have been very intimidating to the Philistines. And now we, of course, come to the problem he had with Delilah. But you see that Samson shows us that God can give special strength to his people. Once he sets you apart and you become part of his people, he can give you spiritual strength. That's really the important gift that he gives us. Not the strength to do what Samson did physically, but the strength to do what Samson unfortunately didn't succeed in doing, to be spiritually consistent, to have spiritual self-control, to understand God's will, to refrain from going against his will, and to succeed in fulfilling his will. And this is the kind of strength that God's Spirit gives us. And Samson is a type. So now we go to what finally happened with Samson. And as I said, he talked about giving his life along with these Philistines. And so what he accomplished at the end was tremendous. He had been blinded. He had been humiliated. He was being teased, tortured, and he was completely weak. And yet now God, in this weakness, gives him back his strength. and causes him to do more harm than ever. And what he does is he destroys a huge structure that probably took, you know, a lot of wealth and a lot of effort, a lot of work, a lot of time to build. Down it comes. Not only that, the elite of the country are all killed. Imagine the 3,000 top people in the nation all dead at one time. What chaos would ensue? What weakness would affect that nation? And so it gives Israel a chance to gather its strength and to repel the Philistines. So it was a tremendous act at the end. So let's go now to verse 25 of Judges 16. So it happened when their hearts were merry, these Philistines, that they said, call for Samson that he may perform for us. They wanted to tease him and torture him because he was blind. So they called for Samson from the prison and he performed for them. And it doesn't tell you graphically what they did, but you can imagine. I know Cecil B. DeMille had some things that they were doing in the movie which very likely were, you know, those sorts of things were being done. And they stationed him between the pillars. You know, that was their mistake. They didn't realize, but, you know, they were overconfident at this point. That reminds me of another proverb, by the way, I should go to. That was the problem of the Philistines. Let's go to Proverbs 16 and verse 18. Proverbs 16, 18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Keep that in mind. You know, you get overconfident and you can get weak because you don't take proper precautions. Anyway, we are now in verse 26 of Judges 16. Then Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars which support the temple so that I can lean on them. Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. See, the top people in the nation were there to mock Samson. How sad. But they got their comeuppance, you could say. About 3,000 men and women on the roof watching while Samson performed. Then Samson called to the Eternal, saying, O Lord Eternal, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once. O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. And Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple, and he braced himself against them, one on his right and the other on his left. Then Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. So he finally gave his life, and in doing so, helped to liberate his people. And he pushed with all his might, and the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he killed at his death were more than he had killed in his life. Another divine miracle, punishing these oppressors, as he had punished the Egyptians so many centuries before. Verse 31, and his brethren and all his father's household came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of his father Manoah. So he did get a respectful burial. And he had judged Israel 20 years. So let's remember him. Yes, he had his weaknesses for which he paid. But let us remember him also as one who ruled Israel for 20 years and who sacrificed his life, who led a successful, ultimately successful rebellion against the Gentile oppressors, the pagans who oppressed God's people. And let's remember the extra help that God gave him to be a superhero in the physical sense. And God can give us that same power to be, more importantly, superheroes in the spiritual sense. I want to conclude by going to the book of Ephesians, where I started with the opening prayer, but I want to focus on the latter part of that section in Ephesians, Ephesians 3. Ephesians 3, and I want to go to verse 20. Ephesians 3 and verse 20. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us, to him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus to all generations forever and ever. Amen. These are some of the lessons from a real superhero. I'd like to go now to Q and A. Q and A. A question comes up year after year. So just in time for next Passover, I thought I'd cover it. Let's go to Leviticus 23. Okay, let me know when it's up on the screen. Leviticus 23, is it up there?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go to Leviticus 23 where the holy days are listed. We're counting towards Pentecost. We've had a complete week, and now we're into yet another. We're finishing a week, so this is what 14 days now, I guess, that we've had. And so tomorrow should be day 15, right? Counting towards Pentecost. I want to go to Leviticus 23 and notice the days of unleavened bread, how they're talked about here in Leviticus 23 and verse 6. They're days when we're to be unleavened, as you know, having just gone through the experience. Leviticus 23:6, and on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread to the eternal. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. So sometimes the question comes up, should I make a special effort to eat unleavened bread every day? And the answer is, that is not the case. The case is that we are to be unleavened. So if you were to eat bread, or you know, if you were to eat baked goods, they need to be unleavened. You should not have leavening around. But it doesn't mean that if you live in a country where people don't normally eat bread, that you have to import unleavened bread for, you know, to make sure you have 7 days supply so you have some every day. That isn't the issue. The issue is to be unleavened. For example, if we go back to Exodus 12, and I want to go to around verse 15. Exodus 12. Verse 15.
Verse 15.
I think I want verse 15.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah.
7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. That means by that day it ought to be out. Start the feast unleavened. For whoever eats leavened bread, from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. So that's the problem. Don't eat leaven. So that's the problem. So that means it's not that you have to make an effort to have unleavened bread every day, but don't eat leaven during that time. Let's go to Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16. And I want to go to verse 2. Therefore, you shall sacrifice the Passover to the Eternal your God from the flock and the herd, Deuteronomy 16:2. In the place where the Eternal chooses to put his name. And so it was done only in that one place, in the temple. And so it is not done now. We do not, the Jews who are still living in an old covenant environment, you know, they still would be sacrificing if they could, but they can't. Verse 3, you shall eat no leavened bread with it. See, so that's the point. Don't eat leaven. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it. So if you're going to eat all through that period, you must be, you know, I would understand this to mean that beginning then with that lamb meal and from then on, no leavening. That is the bread of affliction. That's what you eat. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. And no leaven shall be seen among you, verse 4, in all your territory. No leaven shall be seen among you, nor shall any of the meat of which you sacrificed the first day at twilight remain overnight until morning. A specific rule regarding the sacrifice. So he has rules regarding the Passover sacrifice, but also regarding the festival, not to have any leavening around during that week. Let's go back now to Exodus 12. When the Passover meal is talked about, the first night of unleavened bread, the night to be much observed in Exodus 12, and I want verse 8. So what I'm trying to tell everybody is that you don't necessarily have to eat unleavened bread every day, but you must be unleavened for 7 days. That whatever you eat must not be leavened for 7 days, but it doesn't mean you have to make a special effort to eat unleavened bread every day. Is that clear what I'm saying? It's clear. However, let me add to that my recommendation to enhance the value of the festival. The first night, the night to be much observed, I would highly recommend that night you do literally make an effort to eat unleavened bread that night. because I think that will bring out the meaning of that night and of the whole festival a lot more effectively. Now, if there were sacrifices, if the lamb were sacrificed and people were eating of that sacrificial lamb, they would be eating it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. And to this day, although Jews cannot sacrifice a lamb, they still, on the night to be much observed in Jewish homes, they eat unleavened bread and bitter herbs. They don't have the sacrificial lamb, but they do have still unleavened bread and bitter herbs. And I would recommend that, actually. That's what I'm calling it, a recommendation. But it's based on Exodus 12 and verse 8, talking about the Passover lamb. It says, "Then they shall eat the flesh on that night," which is the night to be much observed, "roasted in fire," that you had done that, of course, beforehand, "with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they shall eat it." So as I said, I would recommend that on the night to be much observed, you do have unleavened bread and even bitter herbs. The rest of the week, just the point is to be unleavened. So I hope that clarifies that. That question comes up often from year to year, and I hope that clarifies that. Now, another question has come up regarding some of the procedure here, and so I'm going to whet your appetite, and I'll deal with that next week. But please feel free to ask other questions. I'm interested in Q&A, you know, and keeping the Q&A going and having people ask questions. So please feel free to ask your questions. Also, feel free to be involved in our Facebook group. I plan to do more, be more active with Facebook over the weeks ahead, and I noticed that people are getting involved with it, so we'll keep that going. I also would like to mention, too, again, that Pentecost this year, I believe, is a three-day weekend in the United States, Memorial Day coming right after, so please feel free to come on down here for that period of time. And also, please keep in mind, for the Festival of Tabernacles, we'll let you know as soon as we're able to commit ourselves to an actual site. But please, if you feel like you might want to be with us for that festival, you know, you might alert us ahead of time that you're considering being with us. And also, even now, although the survey has been completed, but if for some reason new people are hearing me and you want to let us know where your preference might be to keep the festival, ongoing interaction, you know, even though the survey has been completed, but ongoing interaction would be fine. So as I said, we're in a different location this week. Who knows where we'll be next week? Why don't you tune in next week and find out? And in the meantime, all the best to you and yours.